This is the World Vision Report. I'm Doug Fox, in for Peggy Wehmeyer. Join us today for stories of the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. June 20th is World Refugee Day. On this week's program, we hear about one program that's connecting those living in refugee camps to the outside world.
Internet, a bit of machine more.
The internet is very important. It has helped me to see other things, like Joseph Kony. For the first time in my life, I have seen a photo of the man who killed my brother.
Plus, the Indian government rolls out an ambitious plan to tackle poverty in that country. And closer to home, a group of nuns shares its philosophy on how to improve the lives of the poor.
Those who have more has got to live with simplicity so that the excess of wealth they have can be shared with those who have nothing.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. Displaced people in refugee camps need many things: food and clean water, medical care, schools. Computers aren't usually high on the list, but that's precisely what a U.S.-based charity is providing in some refugee camps in northern Uganda, where a civil war has raged for more than 20 years. Richard Locke reports.
In the dark, windowless storeroom of Anyama Primary School, head teacher Joseph Apainto shows several students how to go online.
Oh, yeah, starting to open the internet, you take your arrow to the browse the web up here, up, yes, click there, good.
The pupils gather around a single desktop computer and stare intently at the screen. This is the first time any of them have surfed the web.
You see, my pupils, internet, this one is a modern system of connecting you to the outside world.
Several of the soccer-mad young boys want to look up their favorite players, but one girl has a more personal request. A few years ago, rebels murdered 15-year-old Susan Atema's younger brother. All her life, the group's leader, Joseph Kony, has remained something of a mythical figure. Susan has always been able to listen to radio reports about the war, but she says the internet is helping her to understand more.
Internet, a bit of machine more.
The internet is very important. It has helped me to see other things, like Joseph Kony. For the first time in my life, I have seen a photo of the man who killed my brother.
The conflict that killed Susan's brother has gone on for the past 20 years, effectively cutting off the north from the rest of the country. Despite growing hopes for peace, 1.5 million people still live in camps like this one. The computer here was installed by an American not-for-profit organization called Invenio. Its designer and Invenio's co-founder, Mark Summer, says getting online can help break the refugees' dependency on outsiders.
There are many organizations providing clean water and food, and this is clearly some of the basic conditions need to be met. The question is, how do they move on, and how can people change their own circumstance? And information is the first requirement to change your own circumstance.
You could argue a peace treaty is more pressing, but that could take years. In the meantime, now that there's relative stability, many in northern Uganda are beginning the process of returning home. They're looking to forge their own futures after decades of relying on aid agencies. Summer says computers will help them.
People are very entrepreneurial in these areas. Now being able to communicate with other people in the area and outside of the region using the internet technology, just to Kampala, the capital of Uganda, to get some information on prices and buying goods and so forth, this is really important.
Summer's computers are specifically designed for remote, rural environments like this one with no electricity. Standing outside the school, he points to the roof.
We've got here on the roof two components. One is a solar panel, which provides us the power to run the computer and the communications gear. And the second part is an antenna with a wireless access point connected to it, which allows us to get the internet access and phone communication into the primary school here.
The sun's energy alone is enough to provide the 20 watts of power these desktops require. Conventional computers need closer to 120 watts. These computers can even run off a car battery. They're designed without too many fancy applications, but they do have color screens and flash memory. And Summer says the technology lets teachers access an almost infinite amount of information in a region where most school books have been destroyed by war. In the last 5 months, five other desktops have been installed in separate camps. There have, of course, been teething problems, like rainwater in the transmitter and mice gnawing through wires. But the computers are proving reliable, And back at Anyama Primary School, sites like Google are opening up a new world. For student Susan Otema, having access to this knowledge might do more than show her a picture of the man who killed her brother. It might help her to get on with her own life too. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Anyama, Northern Uganda.
India recently rolled out one of the largest poverty relief programs in the world. But the government is not giving away money or other handouts. Instead, it's guaranteeing poor people a few paid work days each year. The jobs go mostly to unskilled laborers who earn about $2 a day working on a variety of projects around the country. This program will cost the Indian government about $4 billion. Meehan Ridge reported this story for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with Peggy Waymeyer.
The basic idea behind this program is to tackle one of the biggest problems that modern India is facing, which is the exodus of poor people from the countryside into the cities, which don't have the infrastructure to deal with their present populations, let alone new populations. So the idea is to give work to keep people in the places that they live. And Indians who are poor are entitled under this new scheme to 100 days of work at the minimum wage, wherever and whoever they are.
Are they having to just create jobs that aren't necessary, or are these real jobs that need to be filled?
Well, this is one of the slightly dubious bits of the scheme that's earned lots of criticism, because 60% of the funds for this project must go, under the terms of the Act that governs the scheme, to unskilled labour. So that's a lot of money going to people who don't actually know how to do the things that India really needs, build schools, hospitals, roads. So at the moment, people are doing sort of ditch digging, building ponds, doing irrigation schemes. And the ones I visited, you know, even to a non-expert, non-engineer like me, I could just see that the things they were doing were going to be washed away by the monsoon in a couple of years.
So what the government is doing, in order to keep people without jobs in the countryside from streaming into the cities, they're offering them a minimum of 100 days' work. Can they make enough money to survive off 100 days of work?
Well, the people I met in southern Rajasthan, I visited a couple of projects, a couple of sites there, and the people I spoke to there said that it was because the salaries that they were getting were much, much higher than in the past. So, for example, there was a woman who used to commute every summer when the rains dried up and the farming basically stops in Rajasthan, which is a desert state. She used to go to Haryana to make plaster of Paris Hindu statues, and she used to get 50 rupees there a day, and now she gets 100. So it's like the equivalent of earning twice as much, really.
And this money is enough to keep them, to keep their families surviving and not having to come to the cities to beg.
Well, the minimum wage under the terms of this scheme, because the minimum wage varies a lot from state to state, is 60 rupees, and that's a lot more than the women I talked to in Rajasthan had been earning before. But one of the other really important things about this scheme is what happens when poor people migrate is that they take their children with them, either to cities or to other states, to small towns, to earn money. So their children don't get an opportunity for a proper education, and that's one of the reasons why the government's really backing the scheme and putting lots of money into it, because they want to give children of the very poor a chance to break the cycle and be educated and move onwards and upwards.
Meehan, you visited one of the work sites. Can you tell us a little bit about it? What did you see? How many people were working and what kind of work were they doing?
Yeah, there were about 43 people, mostly women, as is the case in Rajasthan. It's the women who tend to do the manual labor, dressed in very beautiful, bright colored clothes, as people there do. They were building a flood defense wall outside a village. So there was a few of them breaking up this very, very hard, dry earth with a pickaxe, and others shoveling the earth into panniers, which they carry on their heads, carry over to the wall, and then build the wall. It was very simple, but back-breaking work. And there are some other big innovations at this particular work site. Generally speaking, in Rajasthan, even though it's mostly the women who do the manual labor, the sort of boss, the foreman of the site, is always a man. But Jalore, this district in Rajasthan, has introduced a law whereby a third of the foremen have to be women, a third of the bosses have to be women.
And did you speak to any of the women about how this program was affecting their lives so far? Maybe it was too early to tell, but what were their thoughts about it?
Well, this project has been running since last May, so it was possible to see that it really was making a difference to their lives. There was one 30-year-old woman with four children who used to go to Jodhpur every summer for 3 or 4 months to work on a construction site. There she would earn 60 rupees a day, and her children would sit at the side of the road with her while she built roads and buildings. This in her present job, she earns 100 rupees a day, which is already a big improvement. All her children are at school for the first time, and she's not having to worry about what she will do when the really bad weather comes. She's feeling settled, she says, for the first time in years.
How does it actually work? The federal government takes this program out and allocates it to local governments to facilitate?
Exactly. It's administered at a state level and then a district level. So in the case that I visited in Rajasthan, the district collector was a big player in how things worked. And he was a very inspired man who had this idea of changing the way, changing working patterns, making women bosses. And he also introduced the idea of childcare, where there's a sort of childcare centre at the side of each work site so women can bring their children to work more easily without worrying. So the reason why it's worked so well in Rajasthan, it is said, is because the state government has taken great responsibility for it.
I'm wondering about corruption. There's such a massive amount of money going into this program. How is the government protecting against corruption to make sure the money really gets into the hands of the people who need it?
Well, even the biggest critics of this scheme say that this system, this project, has more protections against corruption than any of the schemes of the past. And there was a report by an independent agency which was leaked in January about the scheme. Despite all its criticisms, it didn't come up with any serious evidence of corruption.
What is the consensus about how well this program is working or not working?
People in India are very, very ready to be critical of this kind of program. And at the moment, I would say that was the prevailing feeling. You know, until there's evidence to the contrary, people assume that the money will not reach the very poor, that there'll be a lot of corruption and ineffectual sort of talking and not enough action. But there's enough evidence in places like Rajasthan that this project can work if the administration is really behind it and great efforts are made. So I don't think it should be discounted yet.
Mian Ridge in New Delhi, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mian Ridge is a freelance reporter based in New Delhi. For a link to her story in the Christian Science Monitor, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. Half the world's population, nearly 3 billion people, live in poverty. As we just heard, the government in India has come up with a plan to tackle the problem there. And around the world, organizations and individuals are working hard to lift people out of poverty. For a few, this means embracing poverty themselves. From Montreal, Judith Ritter reports.
Except for the occasional singing from the chapel, it's extraordinarily quiet here at the Convent of the Franciscan Sisters of Mary, home to close to 90 nuns. This morning, about a dozen of them are having breakfast in the convent dining room.
This morning I'm having a banana and a cup of water. That's all I need.
Sister Florence Burros isn't the only one eating modestly. No stacks of pancakes here. Even a spoonful of peanut butter is an indulgence. These nuns are devoted to helping the poor. Most have spent their lives working in the developing world. The women here are retired or semi-retired after years of nursing in China, teaching to the children of rubber plantation workers in Malaysia, and in Myanmar, living in rat-infested straw huts. Like all nuns, these sisters have taken a vow of poverty. In this order, that means existing in solidarity with the poor, living like them.
To me, it means to be free, free of always craving.
That's Sister Kathleen Lapointe. She set up health projects for poor black South Africans during the time of apartheid.
You see, you can live with less, be happy with less, and the extra you would have, you're happy to share with others. That makes my day.
This is my bedroom. If it were only me, this chair I wouldn't have, this table either, and this desk either, because that's too much.
Sister Florence shows me her room. It contains a narrow bed, a bureau, and a 50s-era wooden chair with a seat cushion. She thinks the cushion is unnecessary. She opens her small closet to show me a rather spare wardrobe.
My skirts? I have some since 1965. This gray pleated skirt was made in France, and I've had it since. I might wear it in my coffin.
Most of these women first learned about service to the poor as children from their parents. But the inspiration to lead a life of complete sacrifice came from a higher source.
It was as if God had placed this desire to go to the poorest and do something to alleviate their situation.
Sister Lucille Vio spent 25 years working with the sick and the destitute in Pakistan.
I never asked for it, so you can see it was God who prepared the path for me. And in those days, there was a lot of talks about the lepers. And I was asking God, please take me to the lepers. Take me to the lepers. I want to give my life for them. And a thought always guided me. Whatever you do to others, you do unto me, said Jesus.
Even in retirement, these women live to serve the poor.
Denise!
Oh,
bonjour!
Denise.
75-year-old Sister Denise Paquette, who has driven jeeps in the jungle and lived on nothing but bread and cheese for days, sits in a room unlike any of the others here. It looks like a miniature recycling center filled with stacks of used envelopes, old pens, broken toys, stubby pencils, and neat stacks of empty juice boxes.
I've got old Christmas cards in that, which I recycle. I have things that have been used. I have this.
The
nice
reason Sister Denise is collecting
here,
these cast-off nice objects? She repairs the toys, she refills the used ballpoint pens, she reclaims still usable paper, and sends it all to a school she taught in Malaysia.
When I was in Malaysia for the children, I used to go to the airport to get the packing. When they open the packages that they receive at the custom, there's all kinds of stuff to pack the boxes, and the foam, like. And I used to collect all these foam to have some things for the children to do handwork.
But Sisters Denise, Lucille, Florence, and Sister Kathleen know it will take more than their small projects and their personal sacrifice to make a real difference. They believe it will take all of us. Again, Sister Kathleen.
Those who have more has got to live with simplicity so that the excess of wealth they have can be shared with those who have nothing.
For those who think helping the world's poor too mighty a task, these Franciscan sisters point to the words of their founder, St. Francis. Start by doing what's necessary. Then, do what's possible. And suddenly, you're doing the impossible. For the World Vision Report, I'm Judith Ritter in Montreal, Canada.
In China, hundreds of thousands of children have parents infected with HIV. In rural areas, the stigma surrounding AIDS is so severe, the children of these adults also face rejection from their friends and communities. From a small rural village in northern China, Jennifer Dunn brings us this day in the life of one such child.
16-year-old Mei Wen is the first in her family to wake up. She rises with the morning light and sweeps the floor of their two-room mud brick home. Then she cooks a simple meal of fried bread dough and feeds her small white dog. At her doorstep, she watches men trek through the gray dawn air to begin their shifts in the nearby coal and tungsten mines. She shouts out a greeting to a passing egg vendor. Mei Wen's parents wander into the kitchen. Her father, Shen, pulls on his stained gray sweater and lights his first morning cigarette. Her mother, Li Ya, is pale. She used to farm the small, rocky plot of land behind their home. But now she's too frail. She contracted HIV through a contaminated blood transfusion she received after surgery a decade ago. By the time she was diagnosed in 2003, her husband, Shen, was already infected. Her parents' illnesses have transformed Mei Wen's life.
Yeah,
Nothing about my life is the same anymore. All three of us kids want to go to school, but my parents can't afford it. Now my mother is sick a lot, with high fevers and pain. So my father and I are in the house all day, trying to take care of her.
Maywin's siblings are also doing their part to help the family get by. Her older sister is in a nearby city working long hours in a clothing factory. She earns only about $40 a month, but tries to send a little money home. Maywin's younger brother is still in school. The 14-year-old's education was the family's hope for a chance to rise out of poverty. But as her father explains, they don't know how long he'll stay enrolled.
Local health officials practiced no discretion with our case. They were careless and leaked news about our HIV status around the village. Now all of my son's classmates avoid interacting with him. His teachers always make him sit far in the back of the room.
Maywin also suffers rejection from her peers, a situation that's clearly acutely painful for the outgoing teen.
After people found out my parents were HIV carriers, they forbid their children to hang out with me. They warn their kids, if you even go near that family's doorstep, you can't ever come back home. They don't know much about AIDS, so they think it's contagious. They think it's best to stay as far away from us as possible.
The only time I see Maywin's father cry is when he hears his daughter describe her isolation. According to national policy, Shen and his wife are entitled to free medical attention and some financial assistance. But regional hospitals have consistently refused to treat them. Liya does receive antiretrovirals, but the hospitals won't admit her to treat her recurring ailments. And they only receive payments of about $12 per month, not nearly enough to support the family since Shen lost his job.
Our infections were caused by the negligence of the government hospital. We just ask that the government take some responsibility. This is really unfair.
In the late afternoon, Maywin and I are in the car with her father. We finally arrive at an earth and brick house perched on a steep mountainside. We have traveled to this village on a dinner invitation from friends, but they don't know about Shen's HIV status. As we walk up to the house, Shen tells me quietly he's not sure he'd be invited to their table if they did know. At dinner, the men barely touch the platters of fish, fried peanuts, and broiled pig feet, favoring instead boisterous toasts of wine and homemade sorghum whiskey. Maywin sits beside her father and gently reminds him not to drink too much, but she seems content to see him relaxed and enjoying himself. It's late when the family returns home. Maywin's mother is already asleep. Her father, a little tipsy, gets ready for bed. Maywin steps out into the cold night air. When I ask her to share some final comments about her life, her thoughts turn towards her parents.
I hope that my parents can stop worrying so much about us and feel confident about our futures.
She says she also hopes for more compassion towards her family, but knows that will come only with greater understanding of HIV in rural regions like this one. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jennifer Dunn in Hebei, China.
That story was produced with support from the International Reporting Project. Zimbabwe is a country in crisis after weeks of stalling. President Mugabe finally set the date for a presidential runoff election. According to official election results, neither he nor the opposition candidate received enough votes for an outright victory in the March presidential election. There have been reports of violence, intimidation, and torture ahead of the runoff. Opposition leaders have been arrested. Opposition rallies have been banned, and Western diplomats have been harassed. Humanitarian organizations have been ordered to stop delivering aid to millions of people who depend on them for food, medicine, and other basics. Hyperinflation means even staple foods are out of reach in a country where more than 80% of the population is unemployed. Kerry Costanza was recently in Zimbabwe doing aid work with World Vision, the sponsor of the show. She experienced the effects of rampant inflation and food shortages firsthand while she was there. Kerry left the country just before the current crackdown, and she sent us this story from her aid worker's diary.
Inflation means it's hard to get food and clothing, all the basics, but the fuel shortages cause great heartache. Aid agencies cope by loading fuel into the backs of trucks and land cruisers and carrying it with them. This practice can have near-deadly consequences. Zimbabwean Mjabalisi Mkandla works for World Vision. He travels long distances to ensure the country's hungry people get food. But about a year ago, Mjabalisi's work and his life nearly ended due to the fuel crisis. Here's what happened. Mjabalisi was traveling by truck carrying relief supplies. He was also carrying drums of extra gasoline. He told me, as the truck approached a bridge, it hit a bump. Suddenly, fire was everywhere. The flash of fire combined with a horrifying sound, a man's screams. Mjabalisi's colleague, who was sitting in the back seat, was trapped. The driver was terrified. He jumped out of the car, now filled with flames. Mjabalisi was able to stop the car by applying the brakes from his seat on the passenger side. Then he opened the back door and let the backseat passenger out. Mjabalisi says he believes it was divine intervention that saved him. Because of that experience, Mjabalisi, a husband and father of a toddler, says he now lives each day to the fullest, committing all his travel into God's hands. A few days after he tells me this story, I commit my travel into God's hands. We were waiting at the World Vision office in Bulawayo as staff tried to scrape up enough fuel to get us back to Harare, where we had to catch a flight home the next day. It took hours because the staff had to siphon fuel from other vehicles in the parking lot to fill the drums we'd be carrying. Finally, they wedged the plastic containers between our suitcases so they wouldn't tip over. We begin the long drive back to Harare, carrying the fuel in the back just in case we run out. My eyes are on the scenery flashing by, but my thoughts are with those gas containers in the back. I think of the people standing in lines for food and water, just hours away from one of the most spectacular water displays on planet Earth, Victoria Falls. The contrast between so much and so little makes for a jumble of feelings in my head. I lean my face against the window so I can see the stars, bright tonight in a place with little electricity to dim their glow. The faint smell of gasoline tickles my nose.
Carrie Costanza works in the communications department of World Vision. And that brings us to the end of our show today. Remember, you can hear us on the web anytime at worldvisionreport.org. Our radio team includes Doug Boyles, Mark Bandy, Christina Darden, and Cynthia Graber. And I'm Doug Fox, sitting in for Peggy Wehmeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.